You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
We were the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, welcome back to episode 11 of the Untaming Podcast. 11. In a few of the previous episodes, I alluded to moving back to New Zealand from Portugal. The first 10 episodes of this podcast were recorded while we were still living in Portugal. Today's one and all future episodes have been recorded since my return to New Zealand a few weeks ago. You may remember in my episode with Charlie Brooke that I touched on my pet peeve of praising children with the statement of good girl or good boy. I said that I found it condescending, unnecessarily separating girls and boys, and praising the wrong thing altogether. I've never said good boy to my son, but it's still a pretty common phrase for pretty much everyone who interacts with a child to use without even thinking. I usually say, well done, that's right, you're doing it, that's kind of you, or focusing on the actual task. With that in mind, in our society, we do tend to overpraise anyway, so now I'm trying to allow him to be motivated intrinsically rather than always looking to others for that external praise. I'm bringing this all up because this week something happened that I just have to share with you. My son was trying to cut a kiwi fruit in half and he said, I can't do it. I'm not a good boy, Mama. I'm not a good boy. I can't do it. My heart just broke for him. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Alexa. I'm really sorry about the audio issues. I hope it wasn't a deterrence for you. I've been receiving some good advice about recording and software programs, so fingers crossed I have a better system sorted now for our future episodes. Next week, we will hear from world-renowned Dr. Sarah Buckley. I am an enormous fan of her work. It was such a pleasure to speak to her, and I'm really looking forward to sharing her episode with you all next week. Today, I talk with Dr. Katrina Walsh from Northern Ireland. This is my longest episode to date, but Katrina's extensive background in pediatrics and her knowledge of nutrition are so valuable, I just couldn't stop talking to her. Dr. Katrina Walsh was born in Zambia and currently lives in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Katrina graduated from Cambridge University, England, and Queen's University, Belfast, qualifying as a doctor in 1999. For 15 years, she worked in paediatric medicine in Northern Ireland, where she obtained further qualifications in paediatrics and became a member of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. Around 2010, Katrina developed an interest in pediatric allergy and also how diet and lifestyle factors contribute to health and disease patterns, and so she became less reliant on the use of medications in the management of chronic conditions. In 2015, Katrina stepped away from pediatrics and reevaluated how to regain a healthy work-life balance. During this time, she studied nutrition and lifestyle coaching at an institution with similar philosophies to her own. Katrina has been awarded the Crossfields Institute UK Level 4 Diploma in Nutrition and Lifestyle Coaching, having studied at the internationally recognised Institute of Health Sciences in Dublin. Katrina now works as a nutrition and lifestyle coach at the Food Phoenix in Belfast. Her goal is to encourage her clients to focus on nurturing and nourishing themselves to realize their full potential to grow and thrive physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Last night, she had 5 or 6 hours of sleep, not as much as she'd like. And for dinner tonight, she had wild Atlantic salmon with some cockles, a few king prawns, a mix of mushrooms, and onion, garlic, dill, and roasted courgettes. Katrina, welcome to the show.
Hi, Emily. It's lovely to talk to you.
I came across you and your work in such a roundabout way that I just have to share this story. When I first started this podcast, I created an Instagram account for it, And one of the recommended accounts for me to follow was called Ethical Omnivore Movement. And the ethical, environmental, and nutritional values of ethical omnivorousness highly appealed to me. After following the Instagram account for a few weeks, a post came up indicating that there was a Facebook group linked to the Instagram account. So a few days later, I joined that group. And in one of those time-wasting moments, which in this instance for me was when I was trapped under a nursing sleeping baby, I decided to Facebook stalk all of the admins in this new group. And I'm in a lot of Facebook groups, and most of them originate in North America. So I was scrolling through them all out of, you know, monotonous curiosity, and I kept seeing that, like most other groups I'm in, these admins were from US, US, Canada, US, Canada. I think one of the members came up as being in the UK, and then I found you, Ireland. I don't come across many people from Northern Ireland, so out of curiosity, I scrolled through your page, and I saw that you run the Food Phoenix, and your role as a nutritionist jumped out at me. So I went to the Food Phoenix website, and then I read through your biography. And after seeing your background in pediatrics, I immediately thought, I have to interview this woman. So here we are.
Oh, wow.
Such a roundabout way. Could we begin with you maybe briefly talking about your time in pediatrics and the constraints you found trying to apply diet and lifestyle principles in a government-regulated setting such as the NHS, and your reasoning behind your transition to your current work with the Food Phoenix?
So I trained in conventional medicine, so I did everything very conventionally, and pediatrics actually is a lovely specialty to be in, but it's quite stressful. So you do a little bit of neonates, you do, you know, quite a lot of pediatrics, and you do some specialties, and I kind of got interested in pediatric allergy, and I was kind of happily, you know, like working my way through things, and then probably in about 2010, I think it was, I decided during Lent to sort of properly go off chocolate for the whole of Lent. I mean, I had a long history of kind of going off chocolate during Lent, but I'd never done the full 40 whatever it was days, because, you know, like my birthday's in Lent and St. Patrick's Day's in Lent, and then there's Sundays and there's other people's birthdays. So every week there was an excuse to have something chocolate.
Of course.
But this one year, I thought, oh no, I'll just stick to it and keep at it. And I'd suffered from acne since being a teenager right through into adulthood. And this particular year, my skin really improved. I thought, oh great, I've actually outgrown my acne at last. And it, like, was well into my 30s at this stage. So it was like, not, you know, not before time. And then Lent came, or Easter came, and Easter eggs came. And then 48 hours later, so did my spots. It was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So I thought, well, better try this again. So I went off the chocolate again, and same thing happened. The skin sort of cleared up, and then brought back the chocolate, and the skin got worse again. So that sort of really was the start of my journey into looking at whether food could change my skin in the first instance. And I discovered, you know, like, people were going off dairy, so I tried that next, and then gluten and various things, and then I eventually found the paleo diet, and it just made so much sense to me. And obviously then I kind of went paleo, you know, and it wasn't overnight, it was various steps, but that made such a difference to, you know, like, you know, it helped me manage my weight and really helped my skin clear up. But when I tried kind of introducing paleo diets to children in the hospital setting, and this is more for the chronic patients, so kids with gut problems or asthma or eczema or anything like that, I was getting quite a lot of pushback from my colleagues, sort of saying, you know, this isn't really terribly scientific, or, you know, there aren't a lot of studies to back this up, you need to be very careful, somebody could complain about you, or you could get taken to court. So obviously that was quite stressful, but at the same time it was sort of working actually very well for a lot of my pediatric patients for a lot of different things. And it varied actually. There, you know, there was some sort of behavioral improvements with some things, and obviously, you know, like skin conditions like eczema and stuff like that improved, energy levels improved. But I had this kind of conflict between sort of thinking, you know, so at some point somebody's going to complain about me, and, you know, I'm going to get into trouble for this. And even at that stage, I didn't realize that there's absolutely no research at all to back up the dietary guidelines. You know, I suppose I was kind of coming to that conclusion as I was reading more. But, you know, I kind of didn't realize just how pseudoscientific they were, and how there has never been a randomized controlled trial of any sort on pediatric patients for the dietary guidelines. And for the UK dietary guidelines, there hasn't been a randomized controlled trial done on adults either.
Wow.
And there's only one, there's only one done on the American dietary guidelines on something like 50 something women who are overweight but not diabetic.
Right.
And the findings were null anyway. So it made no improvements whatsoever to the women compared with the standard American diet, which is what they were putting it up against. So this actually did cause quite a lot of stress for me. And the more I was reading, the more I was kind of realizing that while the way that we were managing acute medicine and neonates and things like that was actually excellent, the way that we were managing the chronic stuff was very poor, and it wasn't scientific at all.
Oh gosh.
Wow. And there's just there's quite a lot of, there's just this huge dichotomy, and the way that we were managing was very different as well. So eventually I kind of got more and more stressed about that, and you know, the insomnia started really hitting in, and I got so exhausted and very anxious, and I ended up going off work. And I was off work for quite a long time, and during that time I kind of eventually discovered that probably the reason that I had such a good response to the paleo diet, the actual underlying reason, was because I have a problem with my connective tissue. So I'm one of these kind of hypermobile bendy people, and it turns out I have a connective tissue disorder called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And it's remarkable how many people with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome end up being on a paleo diet and not tolerating gluten or sugar or processed foods or anything like that. So that all of that experience kind of made me pivot.
quite
markedly. I mean, apart from anything else, I was still pretty exhausted. And while I very much believe in the acute medicine, the acute care, the emergency care side of things, I had really become very disillusioned indeed with the chronic management in pediatrics, and the acute care side of things is also, you know, it's not great in terms of lifestyle. You know, there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of eating on the run, there's a lot of emergency work, there's a lot of getting bleeped in the middle of the night and losing your sleep. You know, hospital food is not the sort of food that's terribly good for you. It's, you know, there's a lot of long hours and stress. So so that sort of combination of factors just made me pivot and really get into the nutrition and lifestyle thing. Yeah, because I kind of believed that I could probably do more for the chronic patients that way.
And
I suppose, you know, like in retrospect, the sort of environment that conventional medicine is now is quite the sort of environment that really suppresses innovation. So it's the kind of environment where you're very much encouraged to follow the mainstream, even when there's no science to back it up, and even when it's wrong. And there's a lot of pressure on you to not necessarily follow the best practices. You know, there's quite a lot of pressure to kind of just keep going with what isn't working.
Right. Yeah.
And that's quite difficult.
When my son was first born, I began learning about the tremendous benefits of breast milk, and I'd come from a culture where giving young babies water to drink and rice cereal to eat was not just common but also considered normal. And so I was astonished when I was taught by lactation consultants that by giving a baby water, you're filling them up on a drink that doesn't contain the plethora of nutrients that breast milk has to offer, which means they are not consuming all of the nutrients in the breast milk that they would otherwise have had. And, you know, it seemed so obvious once that was explained to me. And likewise with like rice cereal, a food like this is marketed as containing plenty of nutrients, but they've all been added synthetically. And as in the second episode of this podcast, Arthur Haynes mentioned that, you know, synthetic ingredients are just not absorbed into the body anywhere near as well as natural nutrients. And then not just that, you know, once again, the baby is filling up on the rice cereal, so they are not consuming as much breast milk as they would have otherwise. So having had this information to mull over for a few years now, I realise that this is not just applicable to babies. In our culture, it's normal for our meals to be packed out with foods like bread, pasta, rice and corn. And I'm sure if people look at their own diets, it's very rare that they could even go a whole day without consuming these foods in some form. So we fill ourselves up on these low nutrient foods, so then we eat less nutrient-rich foods. And in both the short and long term, you know, that can't be great for our bodies, especially for children. So could you talk more about the effects of eating foods that are filling but low in nutrients?
Yeah, those are such great points, Emily. Now I've done a bit more training and I know a little bit more about food, it's become really quite a bit horrific to me. So yeah, it's interesting because in the UK we kind of follow up what our population is eating just to a small extent. There is an ongoing kind of study where people are interviewed and they're asked to fill out a bit of a diet diary and they get the bloods test and they're also asked to do an annual questionnaire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, year on year, it's kind of becoming obvious that the closer that people try to adhere to the dietary guidelines, the greater, you know, the higher the number of nutrient deficiencies that we're seeing. So, and the problem with kids is even worse. So people are really avoiding giving their children things like red meat because they believe that it's bad for them.
Mm.
Even though they're more aware of things like fruit juice, having as much sugar as, as some of these sugar sweetened beverages, and they're cutting down on those sorts of things, they're still very much filling young people and themselves up on these very low nutrient grain-based products.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when it comes to dietary guidelines and the advice to eat fruit and vegetables, there's nowhere in it that says that fruit or vegetables should be unprocessed. So it's hard to believe, but the only kind of mentions of food processing are processed meats, as opposed to any other kind of processing.
Right.
There's a bit of mention of sugar and there's a little bit of mention of salt. So the things that people have been led to believe are healthy are probably the lowest in nutritional value. So people are, as you said, filling up on a lot of wheat and rice and soy and corn-based products, even in the breads. When you actually analyze the nutrients in wheat, it's just whole wheat itself is pretty much about as nutrient dense as a box of cardboard that's got some sugar in it. And it's about the same level of what's maybe a slightly more fiber, so a lot of a very big, very thick box. But there's very little else in it. So yeah, and in terms of the actual synthetic nutrients that are added, some of them are completely inactive, like the folic acid and the vitamin B12 that are added are not active at all until you activate them in your body, in your cells. And the truth of the matter is that not everybody does that well. Possibly there are some people who don't do that at all. So, it looks better on paper than it really is. So you're getting these kind of inactive vitamins. And the other thing about these sort of added minerals and stuff is I think that they tend to add lead at the same time as the calcium, because they get, I'm not sure how much you know about calcium supplements, but calcium supplements are quite commonly contaminated with lead, like the heavy metal lead. And I think that's because quite a lot of the time the cheapest calcium supplements are derived from things like bone, sometimes rock, and sometimes things like oyster shells. So with the amount of pollution and the amount of things that we've done to our environments and done to our animals, unfortunately, I'm starting to see a lot of heavy metal and lead and a few other heavy metals really concentrate in bone. So if you actually look at the main dietary sources of lead in Europe now, what you find is that like things like breads and rolls and some sort of special nutritional foods seem to be the top sources of dietary lead, which is also quite a worry as well, because not only are you not getting much nutrition from them, you're getting most of your heavy metals from them as well.
Wow.
And with rice, it's actually arsenic, as you probably know.
Oh, I didn't know any of this. Wow.
Oh yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, there's actually a professor in Belfast whose name I can't actually remember at the moment, but he's into food fraud a lot, or he's kind of, there's a lot of food fraud research. And his department in Queen's University Belfast have sort of, you know, done quite a lot of work on, well, first of all, identifying food fraud, but also measuring things like the amount of arsenic in baby rice, and the amount of arsenic in baby rice can be quite hair raising, you know. It's really very, very worrying. So yeah, so there's a lot going on. And I suppose in terms of when you put our diets into context, it's only really probably the last few centuries or even few thousand years where we have had such a strong reliance on grains. And the reason that we have is probably more to do with the fact that they'll keep very well over winter. You know, they'll keep a lot better than fresh fruits and fresh vegetables will keep, and they're, you know, like a good source of calories, especially over the winter time. And they're reasonably easy to grow ish sort of. I mean, they take a lot of work, but they will grow for you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's I think, and also then you can make some very tasty meals with them. And now we're probably using them because they're very cheap. But in terms of nutrition, they're kind of bottom rung of the ladder.
Yeah,
and there are lots of, you know, there are a lot of different concerns when it comes to, you know, these grains and everything from a sort of protein where you're giving kids incomplete protein, and even the developmental differences between children and healthy adults. Babies and growing children have a kind of a requirement to include some additional amino acids that aren't considered essential for adults, but they are essential during childhood, and those amino acids are actually often best found in meat and gelatin and that sort of thing. So, and they're not, you know, they're not found in high amounts in grains.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's quite concerning, you know, because there's all the vitamin B12 and a lot of the B vitamins and retinol, which is the active vitamin A that's found in liver and cod liver oil, but not really terribly, you know, in large amounts in other foods. But yeah, kind of reducing and cutting out, you know, a lot of the meats, and especially the organ meats, is certainly leading to some pretty worrying trends for malnutrition.
Yes, yeah.
Overall.
What you were saying, so lead consumption is coming from foods that have added calcium. Is that right?
I think that looks like it's the case. So so in Europe, the main source of lead in the diet is from grains, is from sort of bread rolls and things like that. That's for the average person. You know, the odd person who shoots wild animal, like wild game.
Oh yes.
Yeah. So things like using lead shots and shooting wild boar and things like that. They'll get a lot of lead from the lead shot. But the average person who's not doing that, their main source of dietary lead is actually from bread and things like that. Now, we're not exposed to the same amount of lead as we used to be, since we've kind of got rid of lead pipes and lead paint and lead from petrol and those sorts of sources, but it's still out there, and it's still, you know, it's still a real toxin, and it's particularly bad for young people, for children and developing brains.
Yeah, of course. And so what is it that is putting the arsenic into rice?
I think it's, well, so to do with where it's grown. In some cases, it's because before the rice was grown in the paddy fields, in some places they'd grown cotton, and arsenic was used as some sort of a herbicide or pesticide for cotton crops. So it's just something that's been left there. So rice grown in some areas is less likely to contain very high levels of arsenic. So it, you know, it's a bit of Russian roulette as to where your rice comes from. So Thai jasmine rice, for example, tends to have less arsenic, and even basmati rice and sushi rice, I think, has less. But brown rice has more than white rice as well.
Oh wow!
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the one that people tend to think is much healthier is kind of more.
Yes.
yeah.
It was pointed out to me last year that humans have not evolve to eat the exact same food every single day of the year. So even if we don't have an allergy to a certain food, consuming it in abundance year round means we're getting a higher concentration of nutrients from that food and therefore less diversity of nutrients from other foods. So, you know, less diversity in our diet overall. And from an evolutionary standpoint, our bodies need us to be eating food seasonally rather than eating the same foods year round. So perhaps an abundance of, say, blackberries for about a month and then no blackberries for the rest of the year. Could you talk about the effects of the body of this lack of diversity in the diet or extreme consumption of the same foods?
Yeah, you know, it's what's really interesting to me is that I think these days that you find that the average person doesn't actually have a diverse diet at any time of the year, while there may be more availability of vegetables and things like that than ever before. If you actually look at a lot of people's diets, most of their calories are coming from wheat, rice, potatoes, corn and soy. And then for some other people, cassava is the other big one. But most of us, that's what we base our diets on. And then it's just various presentations of those particular foods. And then if you look at the, you know, like the Hadza, who are hunter-gatherers, still living a pretty wild lifestyle, and untamed, I suppose, lifestyle in Africa. They're eating actually dozens of different birds, and they're eating, you know, like dozens of different plants and different parts of plants, and, you know, like lots of different tubers and bits of bark, and, you know, a lot of berries and nuts and seeds. And then they're eating, you know, like a lot of different land animals, some of them big, some of them very small. They're also including insects and grubs and invertebrates as well. And, you know, when you look at just the huge amount of diversity in their diets, it's kind of remarkable compared with ours. And then they do have a bit of seasonality, because they've kind of got a rainy season and a dry season. So I think during the dry season, hunting is better because the animals will tend to congregate more around the water holes. So you'll just get more animals, more large animals. You know, it's much easier to hunt them then. Mm. And then a lot of, you know, during the wet season, they're kind of dispersed a lot more and it's harder to catch them. And then, I think in terms of things like honey availability, I think that's maybe more of a wet season thing, because they do love their honey as well. It seems to be their favourite food. So, yeah, so they have a bit of seasonality, but I suppose when it's come to a lot of other parts of the world, we have very, very marked seasons. Once you get beyond like about 40 degrees from the equator, it becomes very, very seasonal. And there are just some foods that, you know, have this short season where you're only going to be able to grow them for a few months of the year. And the further you get from the equator, the worse things are. So if you're in Alaska or somewhere, it's like just very brief.
Yeah.
But I suppose that you have these other cultures like the Inuit or the, you know, who obviously would have had a lot of meat a lot of the year. And very little plant food, or very little non-meat, non-animal food, I guess, because it wasn't just plants, because they were eating things like lichens and seaweeds and stuff like that. Yeah. Mm. So yeah, so but really only when everything wasn't so completely frozen that they were able to gather it. But they still would have had a lot of variety in their diet, but a lot of it was animal-based products, and even fermented seagulls and stuff like that. But still, you know, still I suppose the lichens and the blueberries and if whatever tubers they could dig up and the seaweeds and stuff would have still given them a reasonable amount of variety as well. Mm. So yeah, I mean, I think I suppose the main thing about humans are that we'll have a go at eating it as long as it's not a rock. Yeah, we'll manage to get something out of it. Yeah. But in the last few decades in particular, we've just ended up relying on a handful of not very nutritionally dense foods, mm. or, you know, just cooked in a variety of ways with a variety of chemicals to make them more appealing.
Yeah.
And that just really reduces the mineral and vitamin amounts, but also the antioxidants and other things, because they're also not terribly, they're not full of antioxidants or anything like that either. Yeah.
So what sort of effect is this having then on our bodies when we have that sort of lack?
Yeah, so I suppose what we're tending to see throughout the life cycle is increasing chronic illness, and we can sort of see it right from even from before birth, where we're getting a lot more intrauterine growth retardation or small for gestational dates babies, and we're probably getting more premature babies being born and surviving, which is a great thing, I suppose, about modern medicine is that a lot of these babies are now viable. But right up from through childhood, we're seeing more problems with developmental and behavioral problems, like things like ADHD and autism. We're seeing a lot more allergies, so eczema, asthma, hay fever, food allergies, anaphylaxis, all that sort of thing. We're seeing more autoimmunity in all age mm-hmm. groups as well, but even starting in childhood. We're seeing more cancers in all age groups, including childhood, and that's like both the leukemias and the solid tumors as well. And then as people are getting older, we're seeing, so the type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune one, but the type 2 diabetes is starting to show up in children now as well. It's not just a disease that affects older adults. We're now seeing kids with really poor metabolisms who are ending up with type 2 diabetes. And then obviously as we're going older, we're seeing huge rises in things like Alzheimer's. So in the UK, Alzheimer's is now the number one killer, which is
wow.
Yeah, it's kind of horrifying, isn't it? I mean, and people who are born after 1960 have a 50-50 chance of being diagnosed with some form of cancer in the UK.
It's so high. Wow.
It's kind of every other person. And heart disease is still a huge problem. So yeah. I mean, we've got all these epidemics of modern diseases. They're kind of like plagues. Yeah. And we can't really say that it's all due to genetics, because genetic things change very, very gradually. So there's certainly a huge environmental component to it. I mean, it's not all going to be just because of diet. There are lots of other things that have been changing with us, alongside diet. But yeah, diet will certainly play a role there.
Yeah. Do you have any insight to share with us on the complex issues of glyphosate?
Yeah, I mean, those are really good questions. So it's not something that I've looked into in massive amounts of detail. So I know Stephanie Seneff is probably one of the leading experts in that area. So she might be up for chatting to you on a podcast. But from my understanding, so glyphosate does quite a number of things. So as you know, it's a herbicide, and it is known to act on the shikimate pathway, which mammals don't have. And then sort of, companies kind of reassured us into saying, well, you don't have the shikimate pathway, it couldn't possibly have any effects on anything else in the body, even though it looks pretty much like glycine, which is like one of your commonest amino acids. But it turns out that it does actually interfere a lot with how glycine acts in our bodies. And glycine is a really important amino acid for making our connective tissues. So that's, it's basically the connective tissues are like the glue that holds us together. So our skin and our joints have a lot of connective tissue, but it's everywhere. Like it surrounds our brains and our nerve cells, and we've got it in our heart valves, and it holds our guts together. And, it's the collagen is the most abundant protein in the human body. So it's really quite important. And then other things that glycine is involved in are things like our elimination pathways and antioxidants and detoxification and stuff. So when you look at some of the mechanistic studies on glyphosate, there are some very worrying effects on mitochondria. So mitochondria they're what run our metabolism. There's something called our powerhouses. And they're like little factories, little energy factories or power plants, or even like little batteries that produce nearly all of our energy. And when things go wrong with the mitochondria, things go very, very, very badly wrong for us. So they're not something really that we should be messing with. And then glyphosate, it has other effects as well. So it can act as a chelating agent. So it can actually bind to minerals, so things like calcium and magnesium and iron and zinc and stuff like that, and hold on to them so that they can't be absorbed, and they can't be absorbed either by the plants or by us, which is a bit of a problem, because that it sort of means that people who are eating a diet that's not very nutrient dense to start off with aren't even getting the benefits of the nutrients that there would have been before the introduction of glyphosate and Roundup and these other pesticides. And then, you know, the Roundup seems to be a lot more toxic than glyphosate itself. So Roundup is the commercial name for glyphosate, and it's got glyphosate in it, and then it has these sort of surfactants, like these sort of soapy things that hold it there. And it seems to be the combination of these surfactants plus the glyphosate are much, much more toxic than just the glyphosate on its own. So that's another real concern. And I guess then you've got the actual effects of the glyphosate or the Roundup on the microbiome of the soil. So, and I'm not sure whether many of your listeners would be aware of how important kind of our soil ecology and what happens underground, all the little life that goes on underground, the bugs and the fungi and all the little kind of little creepy crawlies and grubs are actually really, yeah, pretty they're vital for good soil health. So when we start killing those off, we're just accelerating the rate that we're going to run out of topsoil, which is kind of scary enough as it is. But the other thing that we're learning more and more about is that, you know, that these bacteria and fungi have relations with plants, and they have a kind of a two-way relationship with them. They kind of attach on to the root systems of the plants, and they talk both ways. So the plants kind of pay them for their services by delivering them carbohydrates and amino acids and stuff like that. So the plants will actually make, you know, some of the energy that plants make isn't actually for themselves. It's to kind of farm bugs underground. And in return, the bugs will, it's pretty cool. In return, the bugs are the things that actually get into the rocks and the, you know, the sand and stuff, and they mine minerals out of the rocks and sand, and they transport those up to the plants. Another interesting thing about the relationship is if plants start getting attacked by microbes like fungal infections or by insects, the plants will signal that to their mycorrhizas, to their bacteria and fungi underground, and the bacteria and fungi will actually start to synthesize pesticides, and they'll plant, you know, pass those up to the plants, and the plants will put the pesticides into their leaves to put off, you know, these other bugs. And the interesting thing about these pesticides is that whenever we eat them, they actually act as antioxidants. So they actually make, you know, there's some of these kind of phytonutrients in plants that make them more nutritious for us and actually boost our own metabolisms. So whenever you kind of kill off these kind of bacteria and stuff, you're kind of taking away quite a lot of what's going to be quite important for the nutrition of the plant in general, and then also robbing the plant of, you know, our future generations of plants of good quality soil. So there's a lot of different effects that you get with kind of glyphosate and Roundup. And then I suppose one of the other interesting things about Roundup and GMOs is that a lot of the GMOs have been developed as Roundup ready crops, so crops that are more resistant to the herbicide Roundup. So rather than necessarily, you know, reducing the use of pesticides, what we've seen is that GMOs have kind of increased pesticide use in a lot of places, in a lot of areas. And because plants, you know, weeds tend to be very cunning and quite vigorous and vital, what they're seeing is these kind of breakthrough resistance coming through, so resistant to the Roundup. So not only are they having to spray more Roundup to keep all the other weeds down, but they're having to add in extra weed killers to kill the new weeds that are Roundup resistant. So yeah, it's not really had the effect that was predicted. Yeah, and it's just kind of this death spiral seems to be happening instead. So yeah, I'm not a fan.
No, it's such a rabbit hole. Once you get down to it, you realize it's so much worse than you realized.
Well, yeah, it's not ideal. So I suppose that's kind of, you know, one of the reasons I'm quite passionate about sustainable agriculture and regenerative farming.
Of course. Well, I wonder if that kind of relates to this next question. About 10 years ago, I came across Francis Pottinger's cat study from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. I'll give a quick rundown for any listeners who are unfamiliar with it. He conducted a study on 900 cats. Some of the animals were fed exclusively with raw milk and the other with the then new and still relatively unknown pasteurized milk. The first group developed normally, averaged 5 kittens per litter with few birthing problems. Most died of old age, and after 9 generations, there was no change in their health status. However, the cats in the second group had smaller litter sizes and poorer mothering. The cats became apathetic, confused, and suffered from diseases that were otherwise only known to humans: heart disease, kidney failure, thyroid dysfunction, and osteoporosis. The offspring of these cats were also sick. Their teeth and bones were poorly developed. They suffered from vision problems, allergies, infections, arthritis, and many others. And these issues became progressively worse with each generation. Fertility declined rapidly, and these cats also became more aggressive to humans and each other. And gastrointestinal issues became a major problem. And the most common causes of death in these cats was pneumonia, lung abscesses, diarrhea, and infection. By the 9th generation, these cats were completely sterile and had stopped reproducing. Nowadays, only a few people know what raw milk tastes like, and in many parts of the world, it is even forbidden to sell. Having learnt this, it's no surprise to me that we are now similar to the cats in this study. So I understand why pasteurisation and homogenisation came into practice, but could you explain this to our listeners, and can you also provide with us a comparison of the nutritional value of raw dairy compared to homogenised pasteurised dairy?
Oh gosh, yeah. So that's quite a tough one actually. Yeah, so basically, I suppose when it comes to dairy, you've got the nutrients that we tend to just generally think about. So you've got your vitamins and your minerals and your proteins, your fats, and your carbohydrates, your sugar. But as well as that, dairy contains quite a lot of enzymes. So if you think of the population that it's based for, I suppose dairy is kind of made for immature baby mammals, very, very, very immature mammals. Mm. They have growing guts, they have developing brains, they have developing nervous systems, and they kind of, their guts are quite immature, not necessarily great at breaking everything down on their own. So what you find with milk is it's such an ideal first food for these kind of quite immature baby animals, because you know a lot of it is in a reasonably easy to digest form. But the other thing is that you get these additional enzymes, because baby animals' digestive enzymes are, you know, they have a limited production of them. So so the enzymes that are present in the milk itself will help to digest some of the proteins in milk. They also actually have some interesting properties that modulate microbes. So I suppose another thing that's very important about the first food that's going to enter a baby's gut, and particularly with human guts, our microbiome, or all of the microbes that live in our gut, are kind of actually set up to perform quite a lot of functions. So it's like we kind of outsource some of our processes to the microbes that live in our large intestines in particular. So our gut microbes actually perform quite a lot of our detoxification for us. You know, they can manage some of the things like spent hormones and waste products that we get rid of in our bile. You know, our gut microbes can actually take some of those and make it less likely that we'll reabsorb them and sort of metabolize them a little bit further and get rid of them. And some microbes can actually produce vitamins, like some can produce a bit of vitamin C and some B vitamins and various other things. And they can make some nutrients in other food more bioavailable. So it means that, you know, rather than everything going in one end and out the other, our microbes can alter how much nutrients we can absorb. So some of these, so when it comes to milk, some of these kind of microbial modulating factors are heat sensitive. So, you know, so, and some of them are things like enzymes and as well. And then you've also got some white cells thrown in there too, not pus, but like just a low number of white cells that also help to modulate our microbes. And there's, well, especially in human breast milk, there's even some fibers, some prebiotic fibers that, well, so not all animals' breast milk, but or all animals' milk, but especially in human breast milk, you've got these kind of prebiotic fibers or more prebiotic fibers than is typical for a lot of other species. And all these sort of factors can help to create an environment where you can have a more optimal microbiome as an animal grows. And we kind of know now that the microbiome that you develop over the first couple of years of your life is going to be the one really that shapes the rest of your life as well. So, and everybody has their own individual microbiome, so there's a lot of things that are very important in terms of exposure. So that, and there are also a few other kind of things in dairy that are sensitive to heat, like vitamin C and like vitamin B2, riboflavin, that's sort of a bit sensitive to light as well as heat. So whenever, you know, whenever you pasteurize milk, you're killing microbes and you're hoping that it's going to largely kill more of the pathogenic microbes, because there's no real benefit in killing good microbes for the average person. It's probably just, that's more of a negative thing. But there is a payoff in terms of there are a lot of other things in dairy that are heat sensitive and are actually, do actually support the digestive process, both for children, but probably also for adults who are taking dairy as well. So yeah, so there are certainly people who say that they can tolerate raw milk, but aren't very good with pasteurized milk. And the homogenization process, and that's the process where they, I'm not sure whether everybody can still remember that whenever I was young anyway, whenever we bought milk, it would separate out and you'd have the cream sit in the top. And then you'd have kind of the watery milk underneath, whereas now it kind of like comes and it's just sort of mixed all the way through. Whereas when I was small, you just used to take up the bottle and sort of, you know, upend it a couple of times and it would just mix through and then you pour it, which wasn't a lot of hassle, no. Really, to be fair, just a slight shake. Whereas now it's just all mixed through. But that process, the way that they do that, they seem to pass the milk through some sort of very fine sieve and sort of take those fat globules and kind of break them down and expose them to a lot of air, so you seem to be able to get some oxidization of the delicate fats as they pass through, you know, as they're exposed to the air. So there are some concerns that the actual fats themselves can be a bit damaged by the homogenization process, and these are fats that we, not just fats that we use for energy, but fats that we use structurally to make our membranes. So like particularly important for things like nerves and brain cells that use, you know, that have you know, a lot of very delicate cell membranes that require having just the right amount of fats and various other things like cholesterol and in the right amounts in them and various other things. So there are probably a few things, you know, when it comes to pasteurizing dairy, there's probably been more of an unintended consequences in terms of altering how it affects our overall health than we'd anticipated. Yeah.
Just changing the subject a bit again now. So last week I flew from Portugal to New Zealand with my 3-year-old and my 9-month-old. I think we received 4 meals in that time, and my son, being 3, was given a kid's meal. I was pretty appalled at the foods offered in the kids' meals. It was chicken nuggets, corn is the only vegetable, chocolate, bags of chips, chocolate mud cakes, flavoured crackers or sugary cookies. And then was it one of our flights, it was 16 hours long and we were fed a meal at the beginning and at the end. In the middle we were supposed to be sleeping, but we were all hungry, so I asked for something to snack on. We were given five things: a chocolate-covered muesli bar, a chocolate-covered cookie, a Kit Kat, a Snickers bar, and a Mars bar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So in that one day of travel, my son and I received more sugar than we would usually consume in at least a month. So I felt sick for days afterwards. And, you know, not just from the high sugar content, but also the lack of vegetables and nutritious foods. And if I felt that awful as an adult, I can't imagine how my three-year-old must have felt. But so this isn't just about like the food and kids' meals on aeroplanes. It's the same sort of thing anywhere that serves food to children, you know, like fast food chains, hotels, restaurants, theme parks. So could you talk about the foods and kids' meals, like fries, burgers, pasta, chicken nuggets, crisps? What's the effect of eating, you know, these foods? And, you know, why should we avoid kids' menus for children?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, again, I think this, and again, I think this has been something that probably has started off in America and maybe moved through the UK to a lot of parts of the world. But we seem to have this assumption that children really are too young to be able to appreciate different flavors. So we've really restricted their palates. We have this expectation that kids are going to be fussy eaters.
Yeah.
And I suppose another thing that we've done is we've kind of trained them from the stage of weaning onto bland sugary foods, and not really challenged them very much with bitter flavors from vegetables or, you know, a lot of other complex flavors, especially from things like offal and stuff like that. And yeah, that this seems to be the expectation that the kids are going to be fussy eaters and they're only going to eat junk. And I suppose whenever you kind of have that expectation, and whenever that's what you're used to giving kids is this sort of junk food, and it's very hyper palatable as well. It's one of these things that are, a lot of these foods are created in a lab, and they do a lot of research on just adding the right amounts of salt and the right amounts of kind of free glutamate and various other, you know, the right amount of sugar to just make it kind of somewhat addictive. So once you start, it's all you can think about and all you can really, you know, you kind of get this craving for it. So you have these sort of influences going on from one side, and then people are also being told that, you know, red meat's bad for you, a bit of chicken's quite good, you know, a little bit of fish, but really what you should be basing your diet on is grains. And again, you know, like a lot of those, you know, and also the fact that people have been advised to get rid of saturated fat and cholesterol, and foods that are naturally good sources of those things. Well, it's basically turned out to be animal fats is basically what they've been telling people to turn away from. But whenever you take fat out of your diet, you actually lose a lot of flavor. So they've ended up, you know, creating these very bland foods and then adding a lot of artificial things to them to make them more appealing, both visually and in terms of the smell and in terms of the taste, without necessarily having a lot of different complex flavors. You know, it's all kind of like in your face, sweetness and umami and salt, but not a lot of subtlety with a lot of different other different flavors. So we're kind of creating generations where children are only used to a handful of flavors and they're not used to a lot of other flavors, and they're only used to their food looking a very certain way, which is sort of a beige appearance. So kind of creating, I suppose, generations of kids that are probably a little bit suspicious of anything that doesn't fit in those sort of parameters. So, and you know, I can't really blame parents, and I can't really blame the kids either, because this is what's been presented, and it's hard to even blame the companies because they're trying to make a profit and sell stuff. So, you know, they're going to try and make their foods as appetizing as they possibly can, which tends to mean, you know, weird concoctions of chemicals, since you know, they're penalized for just using real food. So yeah, it's all of these kind of strange, not very nutritious foods. At least with the chicken and stuff, they are getting some protein and some B vitamins and, you know, small amounts of things like zinc and stuff. But that's pretty crucial for child development. And without that, they're not even getting those sorts of things. But it's very far from ideal. And I suppose the other thing is, while we've made a lot of these assumptions about children's food preferences, when you actually look at a lot of different cultures, you know, if kids are used to being offered, you know, like a lot of, you know, nose to tail based foods from a small age, and they're not necessarily offered all of the kind of hyper palatable junk foods, what they develop a taste for is the real food. But quite often with kids, you have to offer them the same thing maybe a dozen or 20 times, because when you're starting out with any food, it's all completely new. So, you know, it's new textures, it's new flavors, it's new smells, you know, it's all very much new experiences. And, you know, like you get differences between different kids as well. Some kids are just naturally very adventurous and like, yeah, I'll try that, try that, try that. And other kids are like, oh, I'm kind of cautious. I don't know. Looks different. Yeah. Not sure. So, yeah. So, I mean, and it's hard to, you know, so I suppose for a lot of parents, they'll maybe offer the same thing once or twice and the kid will be like, you know, push it away. And, you know, when you're busy and you're trying to cook and you're getting your food pushed back at you or thrown around the kitchen, you know, it's a bit soul destroying. And you're like, yeah. Right, yeah, this, you know, I can't blame anybody for sort of going, yeah, no, this is just too stressful and too hard to come back and revisit these things. And certainly the messaging that we've been getting from the government and from official channels hasn't been that we need to include, you know, whole foods. The, you know, the messaging has been very much pushing us towards processed foods and convenience foods as well. You know, it's been subtle, but it's been there. So yeah, I think if we look at different places, so in a lot of parts of France, people are still doing a good amount of cooking. I mean, things are changing everywhere, I suppose. But traditionally, you know, like you've got, you know, even in schools in France, you'll still often get a variety of vegetables and stuff that's cooked from scratch being presented to kids and they're eating it, you know. Whereas in the UK and presumably in New Zealand and Australia and America, there's this kind of assumption that if you sort of like you put these things on kids' plates and they'll just kind of like look at you, look at it and look at you and look at it and look at you and sort of go, no. I don't think so. But, you know, so I think there are some sort of cultural differences around the world. Japan and places like that as well, you know, there have been, you know, cultural differences where people have been, you know, like happy to eat their kind of natto and their eggs and and their rice, yeah, and a little bit of fish and some, you know, some vegetables and stuff like that. Things are changing there as well. And, you know, they are getting their bagels and their cereals and their toasts and stuff is starting to creep in more with younger generations. But that's not what the older generations were brought up on. They were managing with real food. So, you know, I think a lot of what's changed is more of a cultural phenomenon rather than kids are naturally all averse to including a range of real foods, because they're not. That's not genetically built into our blueprints at all. It's just something that is maybe it's an advertising thing or something, or maybe it's the effect of TV commercials and, you know, honey nut cornflakes and stuff like that, and, you know, all these sorts of things. But yeah, you know, I think probably, you know, one of the main things, you know, if parents are trying to introduce new foods is that, yeah, that this is all really new for any kids, and it's worth trying to offer the same thing again and again and again, along with other stuff that that the kids already like, and, you know, like and not kind of reading much into it if they don't like it the first or the second or the third or the fourth or the fifth or the sixth or the seventh or the tenth time, because, you know the 12th might be the charm.
Just gonna keep holding out. So then
I guess on the other end of the spectrum, we have snacks that are marketed as healthier alternatives for children, you know, like fruit roll-ups, crackers, corn chips, bags of vegetable crisps, muesli bars, string cheese, those individual plastic containers of yogurt with added nutrients like the extra calcium?
Yeah, extra protein, yeah.
Yeah, none of them are actually real food, so how great are they really?
Yeah, I mean... I'm inclined to think that they're not wonderful, to be fair.
No.
Yeah, possibly a rung up from some of the other brightly coloured weird stuff.
Mm.
But yeah, they're not really ideal either. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, probably what we've been talking about before is that, you know, the nose-to-tail eating varieties of non-animal products, not just plants, but, you know, fungi and a bit of seaweed and various other things a wide variety of things. It can make it hard when it comes to snacks, but even things, I'm starting to notice things like jerky and biltong in our shops.
Oh, yes.
That don't necessarily have an awful lot of additives. And, you know, if you can manage to have little bits of vegetables, even carrot sticks and stuff like that, and if the kids can tolerate nuts, and if there's nobody with nut allergies and stuff, you know, those are great little snacks as well. There's lots of, even olives, if they'll entertain those. and a bit of homemade guacamole or something like that as well. It's always nice, and it doesn't necessarily take an awfully long time to make either. Sort of one of those easy ones.
No, those are good. Some good recommendations. So then, what are some misconceptions about healthy food?
Yeah. So when I have new clients, sort of starting that, you know, quite often it's taking their kind of long held beliefs and just sort of like turning them all upside down. So it's a bit like taking the food pyramid and just tipping it on its head.
Yeah.
So, by and large, most of the advice that we've had since probably about the 1970s or 1980s is kind of the polar opposite of what we should be doing. So heart healthy whole grains, probably. So that's a huge kind of, that's just a huge no-no. whole grains are just nutritionally junk, particularly gluten containing ones. Low fat dogma, I mean, that's been, you know, quite a disaster. That's just meant that people have, you know, increased their intake of refined carbohydrates. Yeah, you know, to be fair, you know, a lot of people tolerate carbohydrates as a food group very, very well. But a lot of the carbohydrates that people tolerate are actually tubers and things like that. So, and some people do seem to get on fine with some grains as well. And rice seems to be tolerated better than a lot of the whole grains. But yeah, I think probably one of the things that really bugs me is fiber equals whole grains. Just this belief that there isn't fiber in any other food group, except, you know, how do you increase your fiber? Oh, you eat more whole grains. It's like, it's just about the worst source of fiber.
Mm.
Yeah, so the fact that things like, different mushrooms, medicinal mushrooms in particular, are wonderful sources of fiber. And, nuts and seeds are also great sources of fiber. Coconuts are pretty wonderful. And then you've got all these different sort of vegetables as well, you know, leafy vegetables and fruits and things like avocados and stuff. Seaweeds as well, they're a great source of fiber. And then you've got all these root vegetables, these fibrous root vegetables like artichokes. In my family, do you know the Jerusalem artichokes? I don't know if you call them sunchokes.
Yes, it's the same thing. Yeah, Jerusalem artichokes. Yeah.
In our family, we used to call them artichokes because they always give us so much wind. Sorry.
That's great.
a lot of different tubers, tiger nuts as well, or, you know, all those sorts of things are great sources of fiber. Even kind of green bananas like plantains and stuff like that and legumes, you know, they're not something that I eat a lot of, but things like lentils and chickpeas, you know, a lot of people get away with, and traditionally, you know, sprouted beans and soaked beans and stuff. Some people do get away with pretty well. And they're, you know, anything that gives you wind is always a good source of fiber. And as well as that, you know, all the alliums. So that's the garlics and onions and leeks and shallots and, you know, all those sort of family of things are very fibrous. And then you even can even get into some sort of medicinal type things like astragalus, which is really odd. I don't know if you've come across it or tried cooking with it.
No, I haven't heard of it. No.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. It's this root vegetable. You get it kind of dried and sliced up in Asian supermarkets, and it's actually got some great immune supporting effects, and it's very good for supporting connective tissue and leaky gut, and it's great for fighting viruses and stuff. So it's something that people pop into their soups in Asia, and into their stocks, especially coming into the start of winter, so that they can fend off the flu. But it's
brilliant.
Yeah, it's a bit like boots. It's very fibrous, but you sort of like put it in and give it a, you know, cook it and boil it up, and then you actually hook it out because it's, yeah. Well, you can cook it down after a few hours, but yeah.
What did you say it was called again? Sorry.
Astragalus. A S T R A G A L U S. I think it is.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I'm gonna look that up.
Yeah, it's a really cool little thing. So yeah, so there are all these different sort of sources of fibre. So that's kind of something that really, and I did mention seaweeds, didn't I? Yeah, that's a good source of fibre.
Yes, yeah.
So there are all these different sources of fibre, but whenever you say increase your intake of fibre, people go, whole grains. That really annoys me.
Yeah, more bread.
Cholesterol being bad for you, and cholesterol in the diet, increasing cholesterol in the blood. And cholesterol in the blood actually causing heart attacks. All of that kind of annoys me because basically none of it's really true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cholesterol, the essential nutrient without which we kind of die. Let me see. Red meat being bad for you. So that's, again, another terrible, just non-science nonsense. Yeah, that's a huge one. Liver being kind of... full of toxins. And again, you know, there's an element of truth with that if your animal has been exposed to a lot of man-made toxins. So if you've got this intensively reared animals, because, you know, the liver kind of, its job is to help, one of its many jobs is to help to manage toxins, but it doesn't store them by default. It kind of exports them back into the blood to be removed in the kidneys or through the breath or through the skin or out into the bile, but you know, it doesn't hang on to them, and it does kind of store some vitamins and minerals as well. But yeah, I think when it comes to these kind of, some of these persistent man-made toxins, the liver doesn't necessarily know how to manage them. So for some of them, I suppose that might be a problem. But if you have, you know, like well-reared animals that have, you know, been fed good quality feed, natural feeds that they're supposed to be eating, I don't think that's an issue at all. And liver is the number one most nutritious food that you can come across. Salt. Yeah, this the fear of salt, that's another something that really annoys me as well. Because again, you know, like when I've looked at one or two of these salt studies, and they've given people in these groups either 17 grams of salt, so like that's not 7 but 17 grams of salt a day, which is really hard to do unless you're knocking back salt tablets. And this was in a group of hypertensive people, so people with high blood pressure, and they found that 2 out of 3 people with high blood pressure, whenever they ate 17 grams of salt every day, their blood pressure did respond to that. That also meant that 1 out of 3 people who don't have high blood pressure were fine with this ridiculous amount of salt that you just won't get in your diet in any way, shape or form, unless you're munching on salt tablets all day, every day. And they compared that to people on 2.5 grams of salt, which is kind of ridiculous. Yeah, and when you look at the top sources of salt in the diet, it's all processed. It's all bread and processed foods as well. So that you know, if you cut those out, you actually, that is how you get rid of most of the salt in your diet. And people are sort of going, oh, don't be adding salt at the table. And salt at the table and salt in cooking amounts to at the very most 15% of the salt in your diet anyway. So it's completely
wow.
But the other thing is that studies haven't shown that if you, you know, if you reduce salt in people's diets, and that's the only thing that you're doing, there's no evidence that that improves outcomes. In fact, it makes things like heart, you know, heart failure, you know, outcomes are much worse. Diabetes outcomes are worse. It's a real problem. Having said that, you know, babies don't manage well with a lot of added salt. So, but they have a mature kidneys, so you don't need to add salt to baby's food. For everybody else, especially if you're anywhere hot, you should just salt merrily. And the other thing is, a lot of traditional foods, especially in the Mediterranean, like where they're knocking back the cheese and the olives and you know, like the salted fish and the anchovies and stuff. The traditionally cured lemons with their kind of, you know, made with salt, you know, they're not on a low salt diet really at all. And neither are the Okinawans with all their soy sauce.
No.
You know, like the saltiest foods you can come across. And yeah, so that's another thing that annoys me, the salt thing. What other ones are there? Are they the main ones? Eat your five fruit and vegetables a day. Yeah, no science behind that either. That was just kind of picking numbers out of the air, sort of. I think that's probably quite a lot of them, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you. I'll get to the next question then. So what could be done on a large scale to encourage a more nutritious diet, in particular for children?
I think the message from the top, I think the message from the government, from public health, needs to change. I think that's probably where you know, a lot, you know, once that changes, I think people will, it'll probably take a lot of people a while to get on board, because it'll be extremely confusing for them. But I think the main thing that people could be doing is to eat real food, to cook from scratch, to not waste their food, and to respect all of their food, whether it's kind of from animals or not from animals, and just not waste any part of it. So, you know, like your bone broths and skin and pig's ears and everything, hearts and kidneys and tripe and, you know, all the bits. But yeah, the other thing is to try and use up the food in your fridge and not buy, you know, lots of new food every day and throw out the stuff that's going before you've even had a chance to cook the stuff that's there. And also learn how to cook with leftovers. That's always a good one. Bulk cooking and cooking with leftovers are great skills. So mostly just eat real food.
So can you tell us, what can people expect from a personalized coaching session with you?
Oh, okay. A lot of rambling, as you can probably guess. I suppose because it's all quite personalized, I try to get to know people a lot. So I do ask a lot of quite in-depth questions to work out, you know, what has been going on in their background, in the previous history, what might have upset their gut microbiome, what sort of genetic things might have been in play, what sort of toxic exposures might have been there, to get, you know, like a good indication of what's going on. I do a 3-day diet diary, which is very surprisingly helpful. So we sort of run 3 days, a typical 3 days, through a food diary analysis, and that gives me a breakdown of their vitamins and minerals and their proteins and their fats and their carbohydrates and where they're getting them from, you know. So is it kind of processed? Is it whole foods? You know, and everybody has imbalances, like, you know, everybody is a bit deficient in vitamin D, you know, but again, that's just a really good reason to get outside during the daytime, you know, in the summer and stuff. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of people with low fat-soluble vitamins, especially, you know, the retinol, the active vitamin A that you only get from liver and cod liver oil, because not many people are eating liver much before they see me. And it all changes, usually, or often changes. And then, you know, when it comes to actually the coaching bit, that's where, you know, I do a bit of educational stuff where I'm trying to to kind of explain to people what are the healthiest foods to go for and what kind of lifestyle changes can promote health, you know, often depending on what's going on with them. So if there's a lot of stress and stuff like that, you know, there's often a bit of meditation and things like that involved, and gratitude practice and things. So but basically then my clients actually do try to come up with their own smart goals and smart action steps of things that they're interested in doing. And a lot of the time it's the main, well, one of the main constraints is their time, because a lot of the time what I'm trying to find or trying to get them to think of is ways that they can incorporate more joy in their life and more relaxation and stuff like that. So, you know, it can be stuff like, you know, I just really would like to have like a girls' night or a boys' night or a date night or a family night, you know, once every couple of weeks. I think that would just make such a big difference in my life. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds amazing. Brilliant. Yeah, do that. And what about an Epsom salts bath? Oh, yeah, that sounds really luxurious. I'd love to do that. I wonder if it's a it's stuff that people actually quite enjoy a lot of the time as well. You know, and trying to get in more variety of foods, you know, trying to get more nose to tail eating into their lives, and also more variety of mushrooms and fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and stuff if they tolerate them, and eggs, and you know, different sorts of fish, shellfish, and just more variety and seasonal and local stuff as well. So basically people who come to see me, they have to be quite motivated to make some changes. I think that's probably the main thing. And I suppose when people are coming to see me, Some people do want a bit of a transformation, but for a lot of people, it's actually just restoration. They just want to restore factory settings because they've been feeling so awful for years, and they've been seeing doctors and stuff, and they're like, I'm just tired all the time, and I've got brain fog, and I'm just irritable and snappy, and it's like, right, so what do you really want out of this? And I'm like, oh, I just want to have more energy, and I just want to feel the way I did 10 years ago. So, yeah. Yeah, that, you know, we're sort of taught that as coaches we're kind of agents of transformational change, but I'm now starting to feel like it's more, we're just getting back to factory settings, just restoring people to where they wanted to be.
So I will put links in the show notes to your Food Phoenix website into the resources we've talked about today. Where else can people go to find more or to get in contact with you?
Yeah, so, well, I've got two websites now. So I've got thefoodphoenix.com and I have thefoodphoenix.co.uk, which is a more gadolinium-oriented website. It's got a bit more detail on it. I probably waste most of my time on Facebook, to be fair. So that's probably where you'll find me more consistently. Yeah, I have an Instagram account that I seldom use, and I have a Twitter account that I dip in and out of every few months. But it's probably more and more my personal page, even than my Food Phoenix page. So yeah, consistently, probably a bit more Facebook is where I'll interact a bit more with you. Yeah, yeah.
Katrina, thank you for sharing this knowledge with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Is there anything else you'd like to say for the listeners?
Oh, I've probably bent your ear for long enough. But yeah, I think just like you're sort of doing. So yeah, food, connection, finding your joy, playing, trying to de-stress, avoid toxins, reduce your exposure to toxins, and yeah, just trying to find your purpose and your mission in life are all really important things. But yeah. Definitely spending time with people who are good for you and you're good for them as well, and just being really appreciative of everything in life as well, just of being here at all.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.